Okay, thank you very much, Andy. I'm sure, I mean, you can join in this as well, so don't go away. Can we have all our contributors to the panel? I should have added that I'm going to co-chair this. Now, co-chairing, I think two chairs for a panel discussion is sort of challenging to the power of four, I think. Shilling Zeng from Tongji University is going to join me in this happy enterprise. What I'd like to do, just by way of opening up the discussion, perhaps is turn to you, Bruce. Let's keep it across, keep it in America for a moment. We've heard from Andy about both from Andy and indeed this morning from Gerald Frug, about this difficult need for city governments to balance the need to drive the city forward, and indeed particularly to try to give older cities a renewed reason to exist. And the way that that can often come into contact with, indeed be challenged by, the desires of the people who live in the city, in neighborhoods, or who are left behind by the great global onward march. Their desire to stop things, and Anthony Mayer made a particular point about London's Docklands, which we've just seen on a chart again, on a map again. I mean, in your experience, is this need of governments to be able to work with, get round, occasionally push straight through localised opposition a key element in allowing cities to continue to develop?
I think what's important is to contrast the experience of cities with the experience of suburbs in the United States. Cities, in many respects, are over-organized politically in the United States, particularly the older cities. Every other block, there's a new association, a block association or a housing association, and every single constituency is represented at the neighborhood level and at the city level. And so cities are complicated political organisms, and they also tend to be very self-referential. They sort of look inward to themselves as they work through a lot of their challenges, and therefore it is very complicated politically to move forward. Suburbs, by contrast, in the United States are not very organized politically. They don't have the proliferation of NGOs and advocacy and civic organizations. They're fairly immature politically, actually, with a very thin political leadership class, mostly driven by real estate interests for the most part. Not necessarily business interests, but by home builders and realtors and bankers, and by the development community. And so, this contrast in the United States with cities sort of overburdened, to some extent, by almost too much democracy, and suburbs and other parts of the United States really not facing much civic opposition to begin with, and then also undergirded and supported by a whole set of state and federal rules in our country that basically fuel and facilitate decentralization. I do think that there's really two separate issues here. I mean, one is the question of governance and civic life, and the contrast again between cities and suburban communities, because in a way they are competing with each other for business and residents. But also the second question is, what are the rules set by higher levels of government? Do the rules set a level playing field between older communities, mature suburbs, the hinterlands, or did they really distort the market in many respects and sort of send development in a particular way, obviously affected by some of the government-civic interactions that you asked about?
Okay, but I mean, you're effectively saying though that suburbs are more weakly governed and have and definitely have weaker involvement from citizen organizations.
And they're basically almost the playthings of the real estate community
right.
in the United States.
Now, Anthony, I want to move on to contributions from Shanghai in a moment, but just it was you who, as it were, rushed in to challenge Gerald Froog this morning
yeah.
about the good people of London's Docklands. Can you expand?
Sure. If I, as a price, Tony and I know each other very, very well. If I shout loudly and talk for no more than 90 seconds, can I call up the Thames Gateway slide?
It's there. Look at that.
Oh, I thought you'd say yes. Right. 90 seconds and very quickly. This is the biggest pile of crap in Western Europe.
You need a microphone for the translator.
This is the biggest pile of crap in Western Europe. Closed docks.
Speak into the microphone.
Closed docks. Rag and bone merchants, dead industry, marshes with dogs
Birds.
And ponies. We've got to redevelop it. The only place that's moved at all in the last 20 years was a state takeover by Michael Heseltine, who said since the local authorities were all completely incompetent, he'd set up a development agency, and they did it regardless. It's now one of the best financial institutions in Europe. How are we going to do the rest, which is, if anything, more difficult than that? Two requirements only. One is a visionary mayor with directive powers. The only way, and a visionary mayor with a mandate. He's got to come, if you're going to have the democratic process, with a program setting out what he's got to do. Mayor Livingstone was voted in saying he was going to do congestion charging, right? £5 a head, you know, $10 a head, whatever it is. People voted for him. He says, I'm going to do it. I have the right to do it regardless of any objection. One visionary mayor with mandate. Secondly, absolutely crucial, a serious delivery agent. Since the public sector are going to be up front with the catalysing pre-investment on infrastructure, you've either got to go down the American route of tax incremental financing to get capital spend ahead of future tax yield. Secondly, allow the public sector to share in the growth of the equity. Bottom line solution, a joint public sector, private sector company set out by the mayor to do a particular mandate. If you want an example of how this works, just as I say, go to Bangkok to see how to ruin a city with roads, come to Paris, Gare d'Austerlitz, complete reformation of the biggest single regeneration site by a company comprising SNCF, who own the rail yards, the Ville de Paris, who do the infrastructure, and a serious developer, I'm sure there's one in this room. There's my two answers. Mayoral visionary with a mandate, serious delivery agent, get on with it.
Right, well, poor old community. So there's a fairly powerful argument for relatively directed top-down government. Perhaps I'll hand over. I don't know if such a prescription would be seen as a bit too statist in Shanghai. I don't know. I'll pass over to you to question for a moment.
Yeah, thank you. First question I would like to ask Professor Zuo, because since so many years, Shanghai is always an open city, to open to the outside world, and we have learned quite a lot of international theories, experience, models, and so on. Just after 1990, we have the development of Pudong area. And also since then, we have copied many international models. No, we have the four modernizations. We took Manhattan and Hong Kong and Tokyo as our model city for the development. And could you present some idea? What is we really need to learn? And what experience or some theories not adopted to Chinese situation? What should we learn from the international experiences, please? It's a bigger question.
I think there are different dimensions of urban development. It is related to the technical, you know, issues, and also related to the social, economical, and the political dimensions of urban development. I think in terms of spatial distribution, we are Shanghai has had you know urban sprawling, that the expansion of the central districts for more than a decade, but now we should learn the experience of other you know big cities, how to develop the nearby you know suburban you know areas to relocate some of the population from the overcrowded you know very expensive city centers to the nearby you know satellite cities towns. Yet have a good quality of life there. I think that that is whether we have a unicentric city or have a hierarchy of cities and the towns in Shanghai. The second issue is I think how can we learn from other cities to balance the development of public transportations and the free mobility of individuals. I think in the past we placed a higher priority to the private transportation, but now in the recent years we are paying more attention to the public transportation. But technically, you know, people believe, you know, we should do this, but on the other hand, we're subject to the pressure, as mentioned by Xiaoming, that on the one hand, Shanghai is developing automobile industries, and so you want people to buy more cars. On the other hand, many households, they want to buy cars. So I think the issue is not the car ownership, as presented in this afternoon. The issue is how to restrict the car use in the city centers so that we can have both mobility and the public transportation. But sometimes it can be politically difficult to have you know congestion charges in Shanghai. But I think it takes time to educate the population. I think in Beijing the strategy is to let everybody to buy cars, no charges. And eventually the congestion is so bad so people don't want to buy cars. But you know, I think Shanghai should take another approach. I think the third issue is, I think, I'm sorry, I have to be sure. Shanghai is in, the growth of Shanghai is closely related to the nearby regions, you know, the Yangtze River Delta region, you know, the city groups in the region. So when we are thinking about the you know infrastructures of Shanghai, we have to consider how to make Shanghai better connected with the other you know cities in the region. So I think many big cities, Great London, you know. Maybe they pay more attention, and Tokyo pay more attention to this. I think we should learn from them too. Yeah.
Thank you. And during today's presentation, many experts also raised the question, how can we cooperate with adjacent areas and also make some collaboration work for the production, for the traffic, and something like this. And since 2000, Shanghai has still again took some many experiences. We invited international architects, planners to do some planning project. For example, the Atkinson has presented the Garden City for Songjiang, and also American architects made some new urbanism, and also Spanish architects made some linear city and so on. So we have learned quite a lot. And also since 2000, we have paid more attention to the suburban development. Yeah. Today we have also a distinguished guest, Mr. Wang Shi. Wang Shi is a leading developer in China. He has put more emphasis on the suburban area, periphery development, not just in the very center. And he has contributed to the city's formation, I think. And in China, developer has played also a very important role since the last 20 years. So I would like to ask him to present his idea. In his project, what is in mind for the model? What would he really to create for the people and for the city?
好，谢谢。我谈三点。 时间到了就随时把我打断啊！第一点，我先谈谈，就是今天听了一天是感受非常深刻，而且觉得是来拿上海和纽约和伦敦比是很有意义的，因为这样比的借鉴呢，让上海更好的发展，中国其他城市呢也少走弯路，上海当然由于它是个，我们来比作中国现在是城市经济，城市城市之间的一些竞争。 我们把上海比作是有点像新加坡的模式，是吧？非常强势的政府，往前推进。当然，我想着正因为上海很多经验，其他城市在借鉴，所以如果它有时走些弯路呢，其他东西可能也跟着模仿。我这里就想谈两点，一点，今天上午呢谈了一个关于这个城市轮廓线呀、高建筑的这个象征性的问题。我们知道上海最高的呢是这个金茂大厦。 这是我非常喜欢的一栋大厦，因为它结合了东方和西方的这样一种形式，让你感到了塔，应该说是这个形式上是非常非常好的，但是我们知道往往干这个超高层都是它要付出代价的，是吧？我知道这个一种传说呢，说这个大厦呢，当时这个中国的经贸部现在取消了，是当时各种大公司啊，金属公司来合建的。 当然建的这个高度呢是那年的正好是邓小平的这个寿辰，是八十八岁，就是八层。我说哎呀，说他如果是102岁，那就是可能就102层了。就现在最高的不是台湾那个101了，是这个了。就是往往我们这个象征性的，我觉得是会有点显得有点过于这个表示某种是不是和有点和它的力量是不相一致的。比如说最高的在美国。 的纽约，或者在伦敦，或者在巴黎，可能它的财力各方面呢，可能这种象征性呢，还是和它相配合起来的。但最近这十几年，为什么这最高的都在第三世界国家？比如说前几年最高的是在这个吉隆坡，在之后在台北，现在当然最高的在在这个陆家嘴还在造。说这个我觉得是上海在这，我们发现这个是一个日本这个财团来投的，现在一直在。 拖拖拉拉，拖拖拉拉，拖了很长时间了。往往这个要盖很高层的，尤其作为我们发展中国家，这个确实要反思的。第二就是速度，当然这个建设要速度。我们知道速度最快的交通工具现在上海，它叫磁悬浮，但是那个我从来没坐过。它可以说呢是从这个市区内到机场呢是7分钟，但实际上呢你要比自己坐车要慢得多，因为它两边都不衔接。 你坐磁悬浮很麻烦，到了磁悬浮，到了浦东的离浦东机场还有一段，所以现在那个磁悬浮呢就成了是一个 啊，成了一个旅游项目，就是做它是为了这个去机场方便修的，但是去机场的人呢，乘客呢是从来不搭乘它的。我相信我们在座的呢，很少有哪一位去搭飞机去坐那个磁悬浮的，就是从这个单位这个速度来讲，它是最快的，但是你要搭乘它呢，你会发现它非常非常麻烦。就速度而言呢，就是如果它不成一个系统，就某一段很快，反而可能是一个浪费，因为就那一段好像就是200亿，但是呢，它成了一个旅游参观项目，那是很遗憾的，这是我说的第一点，这我觉得这个提出了问题。第二点呢，就是开放，我非常这个接受今天上午的一些教授发言，我是很受启发。比如说这个咱们东京大学的这位教授谈到，关于一个城市的如何规划交通工具，如何解决它，有它的规模大小问题，也有它的传统。因为中国传统，我从规划来讲，很大的一个传统来讲，就是它这个居住啊，它都是封闭的，封闭大到以至于一个国家都是封闭的。比如说我到那个日本呢，我是喜欢看这个古城，看了日本的四大古城，从熊本啊、姬路啊，到大阪啊，到这个四大古城吧，会发现呢，它那个所谓的城呢，它只是围了一个小城堡，和居民是没有关系的，就相当于我们现在警察署。但中国的城呢，真正是把一个城市围起来，甚至可以大起来的城墙把一个国家围起来。所以在小到来讲，住家也是围起来的。所以我们现在中国现在城市最大的个问题呢，就是社区的全是围合式的，这是非常大的问题。这里我想举个很有意思的例子，这个12年前万科在上海开发了一个城市花园。如果说这个项目有什么特点呢？不是很大，500亩，啊，也就是建筑面积是70万平方米不到吧。它的特点在什么地方？它在飞机航线上，就是非常不适合居住。但是现在呢，就是它居住的房地产价格也非常非常好，居住也非常非常旺盛。就为什么呢？其实它就有一点和其他的完全不同的规划呢，就它是个开放。就其他的从3000亩啊到200亩，甚至到更小的50亩，这社区规划全是封闭的。而恰好我们在这个飞机航线上这个呢，就是应该是不适合人居住的地方，但由于我们是个开放式的，所以它里的交通解决得非常非常好。而且它这个社区里的它的公共设施配套设施不仅仅为这个小区来居住，而且为其他的尤其都是封闭的那个居民区的呢，也为他们来解决了居住。所以到现在那还是一个非常非常旺盛的地方。当然这是万科一个规划思想。我们开发了将近20年的房地产吧，一直是用着开放的来进行的。我想说的这里呢，就是说我来总结最后一句话，总结就是第三个问题不说了，第二个问题总结就是在中国来讲，这个城市规划因为它社区是包括城市一部分的，如何要改变这种封闭式的规划呢？这是城市规划者呢非常关注的。在这方面呢，实际上上海已经做了很好很好的经验，有些社区开发已经是开放式的。谢谢。
You talk about openness and about particular improved approach to planning in Shanghai. And earlier on, slightly jokingly, I accused Anthony Mayer of being overstatist, meaning that he was determined to come down from the top and just implement. Now, I think that those two approaches, I mean, given the cultural backdrop to different kinds of society, are deliberately counterpointed, almost as one as the opposite to the other. I think many of the visitors to China here are intrigued by the extent to which it is possible for lower levels of government and indeed for citizens to become involved in the kind of decisions that we are discussing here. And I don't know whether any members of the panel from China or anybody from perhaps even from elsewhere in the room would like to comment on this question about how lower levels, neighborhood, public views get built into the rapid change, decisions about the rapid change in Shanghai. officer. I opened up an yes, please. Could you say who you are and come and sit, yes, come and move to a microphone. Sounds good.
Sorry, I'm just an architect working in Shanghai. I think you're proposing a very interesting question. Just based on my own experience, I think the basic model for, I don't think there are very significant attendance for like lower level people to be part of the decision making process. There are other scholars from Shanghai. They could have their comments, but that's my basic response. And I think the basic model is the government, they need money to do the infrastructure, to develop, to modernize the like the night towns or things like that. And then they sell the land. They need to sell the land to the developer. And then, so the government got benefit from the selling process. And of course, then the developer got the land, and then in order to make money, of course, and also help the modernization, they have to build as much as possible for the piece of land. So they both parties get benefit. So the government then get money, and then they can build more infrastructure to extend the city's infrastructure into broader areas. Then to move the middle class, not only the high the rich people, but also the middle class people to outskirts of the city. So this continues. But then what happens is the lower people, I think they have to listen to the government. In a way, they have to be forced to leave their lands, because the lands basically belong to the government. They have the right to move the people to certain areas and build probably low-cost housing for them to live in. Then they have to leave their own land, and then the land can be developed for this sort of a money-driven machine thing. I think it's a good thing for modernization, but simultaneously it's a social problem for the low-income people. Because it's something related to democracy, so I'm just brave enough to answer this question. I don't know if there's other people have their other comments.
I don't want to push an issue which I realize is on the edge of a big gap between what visitors to China will understand about China and what all of you who live here will understand. But I'm just intrigued to try to get a little bit deeper, if anybody could help us with trying to help us sort of understand how these views have any way, if any way, there may be no way of informing this process. And we've heard from Bruce Katz about the way in which in the United States developments can be very significantly slowed down or stopped by interventions from the street level, from the people in neighborhoods. I've no doubt that in Bogota, you were stopped doing things from time to time that you intended to. I don't want to push too far down this line, but are there any other contributions from Shanghai that will help your visitors from outside China to understand this issue?
Please. 但是这种情况是在改变，在改变的就是应该是最近两年的事情。实际中国的城市来讲呢，当然一个是拆原来老房子来盖，再一个呢就是征用农民的土地。现在在这两方面这两年都遇到了相当大的阻力。最大的阻力我觉得还来自于农民，因为原来居民呢，他现在如果是少数民族啊或者宗教信仰问题啊，可能他反对来讲你还不好硬拆。 但是对农民呢是非常引人的进行掠夺的，就是非常便宜的把土地收购来，完了再贵的卖给发展商来进行，不仅仅是这个钱呢是作为一个基本建设的一个来源，更重要还作为政府的一个财政的来源。所以这种情况呢是这种以牺牲农民利益为发展的这种情况，显然是就是它会对社会的造成这个不安全不稳定，这个中央政府已经意识到，现在开始改变，更赋予这个就是农民在土地上更大的这一个自治权，就是他可以来说同意不同意把它卖出去，这种情况在改善。我相信随着这个经济的发展，这个它一定是会朝更民主的、更尊重民意的、更强调市民社会的这样一个方向发展。在这方面应该是上海是走的，相对而言上海在这么走的是比较好的，这是目前的情况。
And can I ask you as a developer, and I'm going to bring Carl in a moment because he's about to move from one side of this line to the other, I think. But as a developer, do you feel public pressure from time to time, not government, but you as a developer, do you kind of sense public mood?
应该说在这方面更多的我讲一个和农民的这样一个故事。我们到城市去发展呢，是政府批地给我们，他为了吸引你去呢，给你便宜，比较便宜。经过一段时间之后呢，比如说政府给我们一亩地，比如说80万，我就会经过计算之后，我说我要给你120万。像万科这样来抬高就是买价的，是在中国的发展上是没有的。就是政府就很奇怪，说怎么来讲你多付钱。这个意思什么意思？实际因为他为了心理去很便宜的从农民呢拿过来地再给你，之后你会发现农民得不到合理补偿的时候呢，你建的这个社区不安宁的，农民他会就去捣乱。这个你这个农民捣乱呢，你的这个居民的居住都不好买的，这个业主呢不安宁呢，你房子它也不能增值。所以这个作为一个发展商来讲，你从就是从对你从长远来考虑来讲呢，就是社会的安定是发展上的一个前提。所以现在到那里谈判呢，就是我的部下都不欢迎我去，因为我到那儿都是来抬高地价，来主动来付。实际上我来讲，我是当然从成本计算，我愿意付得越低越好。但我知道这个低成本呢你还是要付出来的，因为农民去捣乱，你比如围墙，农民给你挖个洞，哎，你补上他再给你挖个洞，这个他这是中国，我觉得这是他社会的一种和也是和这个弱势群体和这种强势群体的一种博弈吧，这样一种的相处的关系。当然我觉得更多的还是一种更公平的交易，在之前呢谈好保证农民的最基本的利益。因为在城市快速发展当中呢，这个土地的地价的增值呢保证农民利益并不是很难。关键来讲，就是我觉得我非常同意来讲，它不仅仅是个经济问题，它确实是个政治问题，是个社会问题。
Okay.Yes,
just said one more kind of observation. Say, what's the role of grassroots? What is their role in the urban development? I think right now for so-called everyday people, actually they are not so, they don't have those kind of channel or they don't have those kind of collective power to do things constructively. But sometimes if they against,some kind of a government-run or developer-run project, they do something deconstructive. This is one aspect. This is usually all those conflicts we see as kind of deconstructive thing. But this is a reality. But one good phenomenon in recent years is the media. If you pay attention to all those medias, right now they really have the power. I'll give you one example. Just 2 months ago,Nanjing city, it's also a quite big city down along in the middle side of the Yangtze River. They published their Bureau of Planning published their draft of new master plan of the city. It is a draft for the first time. So they are open for comments. Then suddenly there are so many media coverage from local and from the national, all those national newspaper and journals.A lot of criticism to them. They really get the kind of pressure. It's almost overwhelming for them. So it means like at this time, for this case at least, and of, and we can mention about several other cases like the Yuanmingyuan project, the media, they really play the role to represent the voice of the people.
Interesting, very, very interesting. Thank you for that. Carl, you are about to become, I think I'm right in saying, move from being a sort of advocate to being a developer, crossing some kind of line. Do you recognize this discussion about, and certainly the role of the media? I'm sure you've met the media yourself.
The real skill of the developer is understanding the political process and the political reality on the ground. I think anyone can create a pro forma. That's not very difficult, and certainly can hire, as we see in this room, some of the great architects of our time and great planners. The developer's skill is understanding the political reality, because time is money. And so the most important thing, I think, for a developer, whether it's a public developer or a private developer, is to establish very early on a political consensus, create the political will to make sure that a development does happen and that that political will is sustained over time. That's not to say that everyone will buy into the political process. That's not to say that it's always going to be democratic, but it is to say that the art of development is understanding how a consensus is achieved so development process can go forward. And I think that probably the common theme here, if you listen to everyone on this panel, whether from London or Shanghai or New York, is that that political skill in different systems is the key ingredient to implementation. I think that the political commitment that Anthony Mayer talked about is not only a political commitment to do something today, it's a political commitment that has to be sustained over time. The major developments I know about in the United States, for reasons almost as immutable as why the chip's capacity doubles every 8 months, is that the average development project of any significance in the United States takes 2 decades to accomplish. And that means that a political consensus has to be established that is sustained over several political administrations. It's not just one mayor or 2 mayors or 3 mayors. Sometimes it's 4 mayors. Sometimes, as Jerry Fruk mentioned earlier, it requires overlays of several levels of government. So it requires commitments of mayors and regional authorities and governors and so forth, depending on the political environment one is operating in. But the key to it is an understanding of the political realities, both in the government and in the community. 2, an entrepreneurial spirit. 3, an ability to mobilize that political reality and the financial tools and organizational tools, including the quangos that Jerry Frug mentioned earlier, and an ability to take advantage of opportunities and move forward quickly. And finally, I would say a recognition that the best is frequently the enemy of the good.
Okay, Anthony.
Can I have the slide up again? Right, that's a pity. I'll make a blunt point and then be more diplomatic. In the very east of London, there's the biggest development opportunity next to a town called Barking. Dogs. And it is called Barking. And it's white, entirely white, working class, traditional, huge Ford factory, they've all got jobs.
there's a huge site just outside Barking where you could put new houses. You'll get mixed communities of strangers, many from other countries. They will be better off. They will borrow all Barking's library books. They might start stealing the Barking girls from the Barking boys. All sorts. Massive threat. The people of Barking will never vote for development south of Barking. If you want development in the Thames Gateway, it's got to be top down, or don't do it. That's the blunt fact, tempered by two things, which I think, Professor, unless you think I'm a complete madman, I would make two helpful points. One is, if you're going to develop south of Barking, there must be a democratic mandate, either from government saying we're going to develop the Thames Gateway, the mayor, we're going to develop the Thames Gateway, so there is a vote for it. The second thing is, if you're going to develop south of Barking, absolutely essential to consult the local people on the basis we're going to do it, but we don't want to have sort of revolutions and farm protests, etc. We would like to do this development that is acceptable to you, the local community. In other words, if you want major development, you have got to be firm, but try to be as fair as you can.
Gerald.
There are three actors here, and I want to know what the relationship is among them. There's the city, there's the neighborhood, and there's the developer. How are these three things related to each other? Sometimes people talk about state and market as if the city and the developer are at odds, but they actually could be in cahoots, as Bruce said. They could be the same alliance. And one reason there's a lot of community organizing, and it's not just in the suburbs, but also in the cities, is what has been famously called the growth machine. The alliance between the city and the developer in the interest, understood as against the interest of the community. On the other hand, the city can also be understood as a larger democracy than the community. So a lot of people then locate democracy somehow in the neighborhood. I don't know why democracy is in the neighborhood and not in the city as a whole, and indeed not in the region as a whole. I mean, the idea that democracy is something about the block, it's just a mistake. We have other jurisdictions. So, but on the other hand, there's been a long distrust, and not without reason, development in done by larger institutions not taking neighborhoods into account. That doesn't mean you empower the neighborhood as against the city. You have to locate these three things together.
Democracy could take place at a variety of different levels, and the fact that it at one level is not any more legitimate than any other. And in fact, what the truly great developers do, and I think this is really what makes great development, is that frequently the neighborhood and the city, or the local community and the higher level of government, are at odds over a whole set of institutional issues relating far beyond development itself. And what the developer, the skillful developer, whether in the public sector or the private sector, really knows how to do is negotiate between the two so that either that tension is taken out of this particular development, or that the developer becomes the broker to resolve issues to make a development go forward. And that is truly the art of development, is to be the broker and, in a sense, in between a relationship that is very complex and goes far beyond land use.
The other place you could put the broker, as Mr. Mayor and I would, is in the mayor. He's also the broker in all of these things.
He's really not, because the mayor and the neighborhood, sometimes that neighborhood is an ally of the mayor, sometimes that neighborhood's not an ally of the mayor's, and usually, especially I have to say with top-down government, the neighborhood and the higher level of government have a set of issues that they're dealing with that go far beyond development.
Okay, we're going to have to, I'm sorry, I've slightly allowed this to, it sort of got going and it seemed, let Americans argue with each other in China seems a good idea to me on balance. But in order to add some calm to this discussion, I'd just like to ask Andy Altman if he will say a word or two, because he had the first word, so he shall have the last. You can use that.
This isn't at all going to be a summary, so that's just a warning, because I won't begin to summarize. I just had one comment, because I think the setup a little bit was also about governance, but it was also about the notion of what is our model of a city and how is that model implemented. So I just want to make one observation, which is from the United States, from the perspective of where Bruce and I work, cities often lack a vision first and leadership. We're striving to get American cities to think big again. We see that in many European cities. We see that in what London has done with the mayor of London, which incredibly impressed us when we went there, a big vision and taking leadership. Now, the question in Shanghai, which we've seen, is a tremendous amount of vision. We went to the model of Shanghai at the planning exhibit. It's unbelievable. It's incredible. The visions that you have for the city really are incredibly exhilarating, and the rate that those are being implemented is dramatic. The question, I think, of what this is raising is the model that is being implemented, that the caution, I would say, of what we in the United States, I think, bring when I pointed out in my slides urban renewal on the vast scale that destroyed many of our cities that we're now trying to change, is that because you have such vision and because you have such organization and because you're moving so fast, the caution is between the connection of the model that's being followed, and I don't have a judgment of that, and what actually is implemented. Because in the West, in the United States, we are now learning 40 years later how we're trying to correct many of the models that we thought represented the good city that in fact ended up in a failed city. So it's more of a cautionary note, not a judgment, about the relationship between models and implementation as you do such a rapid urban change.
Okay. It is just past 6 o'clock. I'd like to thank all of the panel here to my left and Shiling Zeng here to my right, who co-chaired this event. I'm not going to say any more than to hand over to Ricky, who will tell you what the logistical arrangements are for the next stage of today. But I'd like to thank all of you for staying here all day, for contributing, and to all of, I always like to say this, to all of the many Chinese and other contributors who've spoken in English for we poor English speakers who are not so good at foreign languages. Thank you all for speaking in our language, if I can just say, and thank the translators as well for helping us. Anyway, Ricky.
As you know, you're all invited for dinner at the Westin Hotel, courtesy of SIIC. There is a bus leaving here at 6:15. The dinner starts at 7 p.m., so if you're making your own way, please come there at 7 p.m. at the Westin Hotel. Tomorrow, the conference starts here again at 10 a.m. Thank you all very much for being here. Thank you.
I'm sorry we didn't get back to you.